Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately, Kathleen can't be with us today. But we have something very special in store for you, because our special guest for today is Nicholas Mann. And Nicholas is an expert on so many places, but specifically Sedona and Glastonbury. And he has recently published a new guide called Glastonbury Tour, a guide to the history and legends of this very beautiful place in England. And Nicholas, first of all, before we begin, welcome to the show.
Right, thank you very much, Philip.
Now, Nicholas, you and I actually first met almost 3 years ago in the beautiful place of Glastonbury, which is a place which is very close to your heart. Where did the love affair with Glastonbury begin and how?
Oh, it goes back a long, long way. My sister actually moved into Somerset back in the early 1970s, and I started visiting her, and all the time there was this incredible place on the landscape. You couldn't miss it, because right there in the middle of the Somerset Levels, which is a great flat expanse, there is this dramatic hill known as Glastonbury Tor, and it acted like a magnet, and it seemed that everything we did gradually drew us closer and closer in to Glastonbury until I eventually moved there myself.
Well, I mean, it's a magnificent place. For people who haven't been there, please go. And for people who have gone there, it is a magical place. It's a very, what I would say, surreal place, in the sense that quite often what's happening inside of the town, for example, goes awfully out of sync almost with the landscape in which you're in. But also that, to me, Glastonbury is this place where the energy is very strong and the, I wouldn't necessarily call it veil very thin, but basically that there is an awful lot of energy floating about. And this expresses itself in very beautiful things, but quite also often in you know, like when people get drunk, it'll be far worse than in some other settings. And Glastonbury to me is just this magical place. And the tour, of course, is something which you can see from everywhere around. Is the tour your most famous site? Is it not your most famous site, but is it your most personally cherished site? Or are you enamored with Glastonbury as a whole?
Well, the tour is the dominant feature. But of course, as the visitor becomes drawn in closer and closer to Glastonbury, the visitor becomes aware of these different levels of energy that you were describing. And of course, the tour appears as a pillar or a column, or the tower on top naturally draws one up into the heavens, but as above, so below, and there is also a way down. There's a suggestion of perhaps even a mirror image of the tower on top of the hill in something corresponding in the underworld. And this has led to there being many traditions of there being things underneath the tour. In the Celtic era, it was thought of as being the entrance to the other world, literally Anuin, which means the not world, the world that is unlike this one. And that's the Celtic other world in which the soul on death departs to and lives in this world until coming back into a body or some other form at various times. And there are also other traditions of there being features underneath the tour. And this naturally led my inquiry to see what really was underneath the tour. And I came up with it being the source of two springs. The visitor to Glastonbury will encounter two springs, One is the famous Chalice Well, or the Blood Spring, and the other is the White Spring. And the two springs rise side by side, and as the names imply, one is red, Chalice Well, or the Blood Spring, and one is white. And this is due to the mineral content of the waters. One spring is full of iron, the other spring is full of calcium, and this gives them their distinctive colours. And it's highly unusual to find two springs like this rising side by side, especially in a place like this, in the middle of a plain. You'd expect it at the foot of hills or in the side of a mountain or at the bottom of a valley, but not coming out of the side of a hill all on its own in the middle of a level landscape. So I began exploring these two springs and what they must have meant to Glastonbury over the ages. And indeed, the colours red and white figure hugely in the mythology and lore, not just of Glastonbury, but of the British Isles as a whole. In ancient times, the whole of Britain was known as the White Island. And of course, you get the White Cliffs of Dover still on that scene. And the British heraldry, the national flag, of course, includes the red, the colours of red and white. And the English flag is simply the St. George cross, the red cross on the white background. And the two heraldic beasts that seem to come up in the coats of arms again and again are the red lion and the white unicorn. And before that, it was the red and the white dragon. The red dragon of the Celts, the white dragon of the Saxons, that came together in Tudor heraldry. And even older than that, there's the myth of Merlin, the magician, the keeper of the mysteries of the Isles of Britain, awakening or meeting the red and the white dragons that were imprisoned or held in some mysterious way under the landscape.
And basically this kind of like suggests that there is something to Glastonbury Tor as containing something. Now, is this purely otherworldly? Do we just have to see it? Well, not just, but do we have to see it as something purely otherworldly? Or do we instead know through hints or maybe even personal information or local information that actually there is something inside that hill?
Well, you know, that's the... a big question, isn't it? And everyone's tried to get inside. And once upon a time, you could go inside through the White Spring. There was a cave, an entranceway into the Tor itself. And the traditions say that people have gone in at various times. They either never came out, implying that they died, or they came out insane, or they'd lost their senses, or in some other way incapacitated. It was a journey that one did not undertake lightly. And that entranceway is now closed. It is no longer possible to go inside the Tor through the White Spring. If one explores the remnants of the cave, it's possible to see that the ceiling of the cave has fallen down in relatively recent time, suggesting that whatever access there was to the subterranean regions has been closed for one reason or another, and it's no longer possible to get inside the Tor. So physically, the way is closed, but in terms of the spirit and the psychic world, of course, it's still possible to make the journey. And the great possibly even one of the greatest occultists of the 20th century, Dionne Fortune, made her home at the foot of Glastonbury Tor. And I think it's very interesting that she produced what we can take to be a psychic map of the Tor itself. That there is an entranceway on this plane, on the middle, the realm of the middle world, into the Tor. One can enter through the entranceway, go along a tunnel. One can arrive at a central meeting point, a room that's in the middle. And looking around in this occult realm, one can see a staircase that descends to the lower regions and a corresponding staircase that ascends up into the upper regions. There are also other doorways or portals that go to other places. She said, for example, there is a library there, a library where one can access knowledge. There is a place one can go for healing. So it's up to the worker, the seeker, the person who is skilled at entering the inner worlds to use their knowledge to go into the Tor and access whatever region they want. And I think it's no accident that the Celtic peoples also left behind a map, as it were, of this inner world. And there's remnants of this map in the legends of Glastonbury Tor. The way in to this middle region is guarded by Gwynat Nyth, the king of the fairies, the lord of the underworld, the psychopomp. And he guards the way into the regions of hell, the underworld, or regions of heaven, or possibly even regions that lead to the next life. So in those terms, it's the portal through which one can access and perhaps even choose how one will reincarnate in a future life.
Well, and speaking of Glastonbury Tor as a portal is definitely something which I think comes natural just by being there and looking at it. It has this extremely powerful appeal to itself. And now the landscape which we see today is obviously quite different from the landscape which there was before. In fact, before it pretty much required ships to get here. It's only in recent times that the land at the bottom of the valleys has become dry, and so the only things which were above water were what are now hills. And what I love about your guides is that you pay extraordinary amounts of attention to the fact that from these surrounding hills there are various events to do with the sun, alignments to solstices, and all of these things. And could you just expand a bit on that, please?
Well, in a place like this, like Glastonbury, with its extraordinary tower, with the function of the axis mundi, the world center, the axis of the world, with the way up and the way down. And at such places, the tradition is that the top of the axis mundi, the world axis, is connected to the pole star, and the root of the axis mundi is connected to the center of the earth. And around this axis, the heavens turn. The sun and the moon and the stars all turn around the central axis. Now, this is a common theme of sacred places all around the world. Whether the axis mundi is man-made or naturally made, this theme occurs again and again. So the map of the heavens, the sky that we see, the stars, the background of the stars against which the sun and the moon and the planet's path finds its correlation in the landscape. In places like Glastonbury or other sacred places, the heavens literally come down to Earth. And it's possible to find the pathways of the sun, the pathways of the heavenly bodies on the terrestrial sphere. Again, it comes back to that esoteric adage, as above, so below. The human landscape, the material landscape, becomes an embodiment of the heavenly landscape. And, of course, we find echoes of this in the theme of the New Jerusalem, the sacred city built upon the earth with its dark directions, with its cardinal axes laid out to the horizon, tracking the movement of the heavenly bodies. And extraordinarily, here in Glastonbury, we have this unique, almost unique theme of there being a landscape zodiac. That the landscape around Glastonbury itself is laid out according to the zodiac of the stars in the sky above. So you can travel around the Glastonbury landscape and arrive at the constellation of Aquarius, or Pisces, or Sagittarius, or Virgo. The zodiac itself is mapped out upon the Earth. The whole thing is about 11 miles across. It takes, you know, quite some time to journey around. And, of course, you can track onto that the significant movements of the sun around the year, the movements of the moon through the different houses of the zodiac. And this really brings the idea of the heavens, the heaven on earth, you know, right into reality. People name their houses after the stars and go on pilgrimages, walks, and so on, according to the time of year. So to closely attune to those heavenly energies. It's an extraordinary landscape.
It absolutely is, and I remember a beautiful August day in 1995 when there was a camping ground just on this foothill of Glastonbury Toll, which has since disappeared. And I was waiting for somebody to come pick somebody up, and in the middle of the night there was the constellation of the Big Dipper, Ursa Major, standing above the Tor, which was just a magnificent sight to behold. But we're talking here about basically the Tor being this center, this pole which connects heaven and earth. And what other scientists and researchers have been identifying is that whether we are talking about Giza or Teotihuacan, which also have these power centers, that there is a connection with Orion. And what I found of great interest is that you have identified a connection with Orion as well.
Huh. Yes. This is fascinating, and this is quite new research. Glastonbury is made up not only of the Tor, but of three other important hills. There is Chalice Hill, there is Wirral Hill, and there is a fourth, not so well-known hill, known as St. Edmund's Hill. On the summit of this hill is a mound. Now, we don't know the date of this mound, but in all likelihood, it belongs to the Bronze Age, so it's possibly about 4,000 years old. And if one stands on the top of this mound and looks at the Tor at dawn on the winter solstice, you will see the sun roll up the northern and most steep flank of the Tor. It's a wonderful sight to see. And since its discovery in the last few years, we've had increasing numbers of people turn out at dawn, at the winter solstice, to watch this event. unfortunately, you know, given our weather in Britain, it's been a bit cloudy. But when the skies are clear, perhaps if not on solstice itself, but on a few days either side, one can see the sun roll at the winter solstice up the side of the Tor. It's a wonderful thing to see. And to my mind, there's no doubt that this mound was precisely placed to observe this winter solstice event. Now, what is interesting is that if one goes back in time, 5,000 years, to an era when a lot of mounds like this were being built in Britain, not only would you have seen the winter solstice sun roll up the side of the Tor, but you would, at dusk, in midwinter, have seen Orion rising over Glastonbury Tor. The stars of Orion would have appeared in the twilight, rising over the Tor. And Orion rises on its side. If we imagine the figure with its three stars forming its belt, these three stars suggest that the figure is lying down and gradually rolls up in the sky to the south. And as it comes up, those three stars that form Orion's belt point to Sirius. And Sirius is the brightest star in the sky. And in this era, 5,000 years ago, it was rising more or less on the same path as the midwinter sun. So that means if you had gone to the mound in the early Neolithic at midwinter and been there at dusk, you would have seen Sirius, you would have seen Orion rise first over the Tor, and then Sirius, later in the night, roll up the side of the Tor, and then Orion go down, set in the western horizon, Sirius follow the same path, and then at dawn, the midwinter sun, taking the same path as Sirius. Now, this it's not a conjunction because obviously, you know, Sirius and the sun are not sharing the same place in the sky, but they're sharing the same pathway. So it's a conjunction of Sirius, which is often called the sun behind the sun, and the solar disk, the solar pathway itself. I think this would have been seen as an extraordinary event. And Orion, this giant figure, figures greatly at this time. And the idea is, you know, we don't have the evidence to prove it, but the idea is that Orion would have been seen as Gwyn, as Gwyn ap Nyth, the lord of the Tor, the psychopomp guarding the entranceway to the other worlds, upon the Tor itself, and his body literally is resurrected as it rose in midwinter out of the Tor, which it still does to this day. Gwyn himself is rising triumphant in the midwinter skies to rule over this time of death and rebirth.
And when we kind of, you know, see at this identification or this sharing of the path of ascent between the sun and Sirius, what comes to my mind is the research of Walter Crittenden, who we interviewed some time ago, and he, together with several other people, are trying to accumulate evidence for this notion that our ancestors were absolutely convinced that there was a very strong bond between the sun and Sirius. And, of course, the ancient Egyptians somehow felt that our sun was the child of Sirius, which makes Walter believe that maybe there is some kind of binary star relationship there. And to see this same correlation between the Sun and Sirius on display in Glastonbury really kind of like brings that to mind. But also, definitely something part of Glastonbury is the Tor Labyrinth. Now, people who follow Kathleen's research will know that she is absolutely an expert in labyrinths, has obviously worked it in various of her books, specifically the Book of Love, where she tackles the Chartres Labyrinth. But the Glastonbury Labyrinth is, first of all, not the labyrinth, which is the modern one, which sits outside the church, but is really something very special, if not unique, and was also something extremely controversial for a very long period of time, in the sense that there was quite some debate as to whether or not it was actually there.
Yes, the Glastonbury Tor Labyrinth. The Glastonbury Tor, it has been sculpted over time into an extraordinary shape. Not only is there the dramatic hill with the tower on top, but there are terraces carved on every flank of the tor. Terraces that are explained as being built for agricultural reasons. Now, this doesn't stand up because there are no terraces on the hills around on their northern or westerly flanks. In other words, yes, people did build agricultural terraces on the sunny, sheltered southern and eastern sides of the hills in this area, especially in the medieval period, but they never bothered to build agricultural terraces on the northern and western sides. And it doesn't make sense to build them on these flanks of the Tor that are particularly exposed to the weather. Though lower down on the southern side, you can explain these terraces in agricultural terms, and no doubt that's what they were built for. But you can't explain these terraces in agricultural terms higher up and on the exposed flanks. One has to look for another reason. Now, I talked about the winter solstice sun rolling up the side of the Tor. And what is interesting is that in this period that I discussed, the Neolithic and the Early Bronze Age, the sun didn't so much roll up the side of the Tor as it rolled up just underneath it. It would have been necessary to have cut some notches into the side of the Tor, and then one would have seen the top rim of the solar disk flash in these notches when viewing the sun from the mound. It's possible one would have seen the sun flash in these notches four or even five times, which is quite remarkable. And this is the beginning of giving us good reasons for early sculpting the northern and western flanks of the Tor in prehistory. So it's possible that people were using this axis lindy of the Tor as a calendar, perhaps moving to different positions around the Tor to watch the sun roll up its flanks, perhaps flash in notches created by artificial terraces. And at some point, these early earthworks begin to become coherent. They begin to connect up. They begin to form a pathway. And I think in the mythic imagination and the psychic imagination, the idea that there is a road, a pathway here into the other world, it begins to take form. And in the same way as the heavens have appeared in the landscape of the Glastonbury Zodiac, I think this other world path begins to appear in people's minds and people's imaginations as something worth sculpting on the flanks of the Tor itself. Now, whether they were doing this deliberately or consciously or just being impelled in some way to sculpt the tour. I don't know. But I think this sculpting went on for a very, very long period of time. Not only did the Neolithic and the Bronze Age people add their bit to the tour, but I think that the Iron Age people, and this, of course, would have included the Druidic peoples, added their bit, and I've got some evidence for that, that the Druids, there's an Iron Age village, the era of the Druids, that's on the winter solstice alignment. And then finally, when the Christians came and built a monastery on top of the tor, they too carried on the carving of the terraces, not for agricultural reasons, but to create a seven-tiered Calvary mount. In other words, Glastonbury Tor in the Christian era, the medieval era, became the mount that Christ, their Savior, on which he achieved his apotheosis, to which he ascended, went into heaven, and it was customary throughout Europe at this time to embody this as Calvary mounts or seven-stepped mounds. Now, these usually take the form of artificial mounds, some of which were quite big, but Glastonbury Tor is, of course, a natural hill. It's huge. It reaches up over 500 feet high. It's, you know, a quarter of a mile long. The terraces are massive. There's nothing else quite like it. But as a result of all these different workings and different eras, the connecting up of all these pathways, there is, whether one disputes it or not, there is a labyrinthine pathway upon the tor. And, moreover, it can be threaded, it can be walked in a manner that approximates the famous seven circles of the classical labyrinth. Not the labyrinth you find in Chartres, you know, which is a very developed labyrinth, but the simple, basic seven-ringed or seven-path labyrinth that you find in many contexts around the world.
Absolutely, and I mean, just looking at the cover of your guidebook, the aerial photography of the mound, just you can just kind of like almost trace it with your finger, pretty much on par with the finger labyrinth of Lucca, except obviously different in appearance. Okay, I've got to ask you this, Nicholas. When I started looking into Glastonbury, one of the things which greatly surprised me in its history is that it was once said to be one of three sites, if I'm remembering correctly, where there was said to be an eternal choir, which in my interpretation means that at one point in history there was a group of people who basically made sure that there constantly was music or a sound being produced in Glastonbury. Is this something you've looked into, and if so, what are your observations about it?
Well, this of course is just a fascinating little piece of inquiry. There's very, very little evidence for it. This is well worth pursuing. If somebody could come up with more evidence to substantiate this idea of a perpetual choir, I'd be very, very grateful, and I'm sure we all would to know more about it. The idea is that of Glastonbury Abbey having a perpetual choir. That is, a regiment where monks in rota chanted around the clock, so maintaining music, prayer, and devotion to their god. This is a practice. I forget where it was first developed. I think it was first developed in Eastern Orthodox monasteries in the 11th century. I'm not that clear on that. But the tradition is that Glastonbury also had a perpetual choir. However, there's no evidence for it in the records, and was rather drawn a blank. John Michel did research on it in his books, and he thought there were three other places, like you mentioned, monasteries, monastic communities in southern Britain that had a perpetual choir. And moreover, that these fell on the circumference of a circle in a way that divided the circle up into 12, suggesting that there could be other places where this perpetual choir was established. Again, you have this 12-fold map, this very zodiacal imagery on the landscape of Britain. And he's, John Michel did the research in his books, and you know, it's a very interesting idea and well worth looking at. But what, the more one looks at it from a evidential point of view, unfortunately, it begins to fall apart.
It's something for the future. We will say. Now, when I look at this part of England, Glastonbury is very natural in the sense that what we see there and what you have underlined and proven in your book is that there are sight lines, that this is a natural landscape from which from one natural site to another there are extremely interesting displays, and that mankind has accentuated these things across time. And when we go back into history, that this dates back to 4th, 3rd millennium BC when it comes to some of these features. Now, that is also the time period when, not too far yet, not too close either, we have such sites as Stonehenge and Avebury. Now, one of the things which I've always looked for and have rarely really found is somebody who is able to tackle Glastonbury, Stonehenge and Avebury in one go. Quite often Stonehenge and Avebury go, but I've never really seen anybody being able to fold in Glastonbury into that fold. Why is there this kind of like disconnection between those three amazing sites, and do you think that there is no connection, or do you think that there is a connection?
It's a good question, Philip. I've recently done a study of Avebury. My book, Avebury Cosmos, was published just last year. And my research took me down the astronomical road, in which I looked closely at Avebury. Of course, the astronomical work has been done on Stonehenge for many years. The winter solstice observations there are well known, and I've already touched quite a bit on the winter solstice observations here in Glastonbury. So that mid-winter alignment does seem to suggest a connection between Glastonbury and Stonehenge. Of course, midwinter being one of the, well, if not the most important time in the calendrical year, the time of death and rebirth. Now, to tie in Avebury with those two other places is a bit tricky, but luckily we have the St. Michael line, this extraordinary line discovered by John Michel in the 60s. It connects ancient sites, including Glastonbury and Avebury, together across the landscape. And due to the number of St. Michael churches upon the line, it was dubbed the St. Michael Line. And this alignment from one side of Britain to the other is also called the May Day alignment, because if one is upon it and looks up and down this alignment, one will see the sun rise around the 1st of May, or on the other cross-quarter days, that is, the days midway between the solstices and the equinoxes. But were very, very important for the agricultural the people who developed agriculture, because they marked the key turning points in the course of the agricultural year. So if one can make a case in that manner to connect Avebury, Stonehenge and Glastonbury, then let it be so, because these lines across these vast distances, you know, are quite difficult to substantiate in fact. You know, there are all kinds of problems when one really gets down to it. But just going to Avebury, having spent many years researching the site, I am absolutely amazed at the sophistication of the people who built it. They were an extraordinary people. They were very attuned to the heavens. Because today we're wedded to the idea of progress, we think everything back in the past is lesser. You know, people in the past were basically not as clever as we are now. But I think it was the opposite. I think those people who built Avebury and Stonehenge were a lot smarter than we were, than we are. I think we've actually gone into some kind of decline in terms of our spiritual, moral, and even intellectual development. I think we actually reached a peak around the end of the Mesolithic, and the agricultural revolution and then the industrial revolution has led to a decline. And, I mean, don't get me going too much up down this road, Philip, if you don't want to go down it, but, you know, we did reach our evolutionary peak during the Mesolithic, and with only just, with the agricultural revolution, our body size diminished, we shrank, our brains shrank. We've only just, in the past few couple of hundred years, come back to where we were at the end of the Mesolithic. We've only just, people in Europe have only just got back to the height we achieved 5,000 years ago, because of the poor diet that accompanied the agricultural revolution and so on. So whether we've come back in spiritual terms, I don't know, and I don't think so. We're in an age where the predominant worldview is all about the individual. It's all about individuation. We talk about developing ourselves, about, you know, increasing self-esteem, self-confidence, self-worth, achieving personal power and wealth. 5,000 years ago, we just didn't think like that. I'm not saying we thought as a herd. You know, we weren't all molded together in some lump. No, no, no. People were very individual, but they thought as part of a whole. They saw themselves as being embedded in a world where the sacred was imminent, where it appeared daily. You know, the rising of the sun was a divine event. The appearance of the moon was the appearance of deity. And they lived their lives according to this pattern. So however they lived and whoever these people were, they expressed themselves at these places, Stonehenge, Avebury, Glastonbury. They left behind in the landscape an expression of their worldview. If we put ourselves back into these landscapes and walk them, especially at the times, crucial times during the day or of the year, then we begin to get back into the kind of mindset that these people inhabited. And gradually, I became convinced that the consciousness of these people extended outwards, far, far beyond the minute details of everyday life. Of course, they were just as caught up in that as we are, but they understood the greatest cycles of them all. they were so attuned to the subtle cycles of life that they were attuned not only to the zodiac and the cycle of the year, the solar cycle, but to the longer cycles of the planets and to the cycles of the stars. They were thinking in terms of millennia, of thousands of years. Their consciousness reached out into the stellar regions of the cosmos. And, you know, I think it must have been very easy to become enlightened in those days. I think many enlightened people were on the earth in those days. I think there are very, very few enlightened people on the earth today.
It's one of the reasons why this show is called The Spirit Revolution, because we believe that, you know, enlightenment is something which definitely has to come back, and we hope that we contribute with this show to that sense. Now, the fame of Glastonbury as a power of learning, of knowledge, of wisdom, how far do you think it extended? Because there are, you know, it was not very close to Cornwall, but at the same time not too distant from it either. We know that Cornwall was a very important site for tin mining throughout the Bronze Age, because bronze required both copper and the tin coming from Cornwall pretty much for large sections of Europe. Is there any evidence, or do you have any conclusions to draw as to how far or how close the fame of Glastonbury was at that moment in time?
Well, I mean, you know, you can take this on a poetic or a mythic or a practical level, and what you say raises various ideas. If, for example, you are a visitor to Britain, and you do, as many people do, you fly into London, and you hire a car, or you get on a bus, a coach, or a train, and you journey west, you will feel a change as you move westward across the landscape. As you leave the environment of London behind and approach Avebury and Stonehenge, for example, one begins to enter the energy field, the deeper, the more ancient energy field of the island. As one approaches Glastonbury, I think sensitive people can attune to its field before they can even see it. But there's always, and everybody remarks about this, as you come to the edge of the Somerset Levels, as you come to the edge of the Mendip Hills, and you see Glastonbury Tor in the middle of the levels, there is always a gasp. There is always a moment of exclamation, of recognition, that here is somewhere in our memory that we know of, that calls to us. And this field extends for miles around Glastonbury. And in the Christian era, they talked about it in terms of a place where Christ came. Christ, an enlightened being, came to Glastonbury. He came here, he established the first church here, the first church in Britain, the first church outside of the Holy Land. This is how they talked about it. And up on the Mendip Hills, just to the north of Glastonbury, there was a trade in tin and lead going on at the time of Christ. And the tradition is that Joseph of Arimathea, Jesus' great-uncle, was a trader in tin and lead from the Mendip Hills, and that he brought his nephew or great-nephew to Glastonbury before he began his teaching. You know, as part of his travels. And he also came further southwest to Cornwall, that also features significantly in the tin trade that you mentioned at that time. So the aura, the energy of Glastonbury, you can look at in a variety of ways. You can look at it in terms of the enlightened beings who came here. You can look at it geographically in terms of enchanted landscapes, or you can look at it in a very mundane way in terms of what we know about history and the trade links and routes which people were likely to have traveled over time.
When you go into Glastonbury these days, what do you see? Is it a town which harkens back to ancient times? Kind of like, you know, Glastonbury, for people who have not been, is quite unique. You have what I would call an average British town population who go about their business, which is banking and food shopping. At the same time, you have people who seek it out and who've always sought it out as part of spiritual enlightenment. There are also people who come there as sort of an effort of trying to find themselves. There's obviously the everyday tourist. And so this makes for Glastonbury an interesting concoction, almost an alchemical formula. Yeah. And kind of like, you know, for somebody who has written about Glastonbury, who is near there, who goes there, how do you see Glastonbury? What are the positives and maybe the negatives which you experience there, and also the hope which you would hope Glastonbury to see become?
Well, this is a very interesting area, Philip. I've seen Glastonbury develop over the years to offer many services to the spiritual seeker. And in that sense, it is unique. I can only think of a few other places in the world quite like it. You know, there is Sedona in Arizona, important spiritual center. There's Glastonbury, and of course Lourdes in France as a center of Christian pilgrimage, and of course Mecca of Muslim pilgrims. But here, Glastonbury is a beacon for the New Age pilgrim, for the pagan, for the seeker who knows that there's a spiritual dimension to life and is trying to find what that is. You know, and as we enter deeper and deeper into a secular age, you know, the default position is now the secular position. As science, you know, scientists become the new priests, as they pronounce on the future and, you know, what we're all meant to be doing, there are very, very few places one can go and try to find the spiritual or moral dimension to life. And Glastonbury offers that. It offers something. There's the Tor, there's Chalice Well, there's the Abbey, and there's a whole host of shops in the High Street that offer products and services to the spiritual seeker. Now, the negative side of that is that they can pander to the gullible. We get an effect here where somebody can come, they can have a spiritual revelation, which is possible, but then they hang out their shingle as an expert in that field, and they're not. It takes many, many lifetimes to become a spiritual expert. One can have a realization that to undo the karma and come into one's power as a spiritual teacher is not something that happens through an enlightenment experience. It takes a long, long time to undo lifetimes of karma. So, unfortunately, as a pilgrim to Glastonbury, I would say, you know, be critical, be careful, ask questions. The Grail quest, the knight, the seeker of the Grail, as they approach the Grail castle, is admonished to ask the right question. If they ask the wrong question, they're going to be given the wrong answer. So it's all about refining one's abilities. And that does include the intellectual abilities too. You can't throw away the intellect here. One has to be ready and prepared and skillful at every level so one can find what one needs. And, you know, good luck to people who come here, because there is something very, very special, and it's waiting for them.
Absolutely, and I would say to anybody who goes to Glastonbury, you know, and has a revelation, you're not the first. You're one in a long line of people who have come there to seek out revelations and to be granted some. But unfortunately, we actually haven't been able to touch upon that other great site which you briefly mentioned, Sedona, and which you have studied as well, which we will have to take over to another show, because even though people are coming to Glastonbury in search of enlightenment, we have come to the end of our show, which was enlightened by your presence, Nicholas. So thank you very much for being on our show. For our listeners who want to hear this radio interview again, you can do so in a number of ways. You can go to the BBS Radio Archives on bbsradio.com, where you can listen to more than 2 years of our shows in the archives. The archives are for payment. You basically pay a small fee and you get access to not just our shows, archives, but everything which is on the BBS Radio Archive. You can, however, also download for free via iTunes about a year to a year and a half of our shows, and you can see on our website www.thespiritrevolution.com who we have been interviewing in that time span. On that website, you can also listen to the last 5 episodes of our show completely for free. Also, on Facebook, we keep you posted about these things, and quite often via Facebook itself, you can simply click on the Facebook page there, which is facebook.com/spiritrevolution. Nicholas, you have been a great guest. Thanks for being on this week's episode of The Spirit Revolution. We will be back next week with another show. But until then, from the both of us, the truth against the world.